Hello and welcome to Fewing Around with me, Jason Plato, and a man who's rarely seen on a podium. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fewing Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux, well, they're going to tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, Dave, you've been on a podium, surely?
Do you know, I was thinking that. I've never been on a podium in a motorsport sense, but I have probably been on a podium in some rubbish nightclub in Wigan or Warrington or somewhere over the years. Yeah. So if that counts, then count me in.
Well, there we go. A rubbish nightclub in where? Wigan, you say?
I have been to rubbish nightclubs in Wigan and Warrington. But listen, do you know what? All of this is immaterial at the moment because we have somebody who is talking to us from a far more exotic location than Wigan or Warrington. We're talking about the other side of the world. And she is... Actually, I won't give anything away.
Don't. Speaking via them satellite links, which is obviously a great expense.
Absolutely.
We've got fired up. Well, you know, you're right. Our guest today is a lady who might just have about the best job in the world. She's a TV presenter, a radio presenter, an event host. But you'll probably know her best as the face of Sky Sports F1. It is, of course, Formula One's very own Rachel Brooks. Hi, Rach. How are you?
Hi, I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really good. So where are you? Obviously, we know, but for our viewers and listeners.
I'm in my hotel room in Austin, Texas, because I've just arrived for the American Grand Prix that's happening this weekend.
What a life, eh?
What a life. I mean, genuinely, what a life. All right, we'll let you into a little secret here, because actually we were just sort of talking before we started recording and just talking about, you know, what it's like when you live the life of Rachel Brooks and you know, what do you pack and how long are you away for? And these are major logistical issues, aren't they?
They are. So I'm currently at the start of a three-week trip because there are three races back to back. And so I've bought rather a lot of clothes with me, and everyone always takes the mickey out of me. I have two large suitcases with me. Mm-hmm. I will be going straight to Mexico from here, and then I'll be going on to Brazil.
Right.
To save on costs, to help the environment as well. We don't fly backwards and forwards in between. Mm-hmm. So I'm staying out in Mexico for a couple of days, going somewhere else, which requires different clothing. there it is. So when you take it all into account, essentially what I'm saying is when I get to a racetrack on Thursday, for example, when I go tomorrow to the track here in Austin, I will be doing a shoot that will be going out on Saturday. So I need an outfit for that. Mm-hmm. It's cold in the morning here, so I need an outfit to wear to the track. But then it gets to 30 degrees when I'm there. So I will probably have three outfits I will wear tomorrow, and then I'll wear an outfit in the evening. So that's four in one day. So essentially, that's four times 20, 21 days, which is, you know, 84 outfits. So I feel justified in taking 66 kilos of luggage on the flight.
Is that what it is? 66?
No, it's not. It's 64. Two lots of 32.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, but it makes sense that, you know, now that you say it, I'd never really sort of worked it out like that, you know, because essentially, you know, Jason and I spend most of our time in a pair of tracky bottoms. I mean, obviously, you know, one.
Well,
each.
You speak for yourself. Shorts are my chosen weapon.
But when you're working, and you're working in different climates as well, as you say, I mean, listen, I've learned something already. I didn't know that it got cold in Austin, Texas in the morning, did you say, or at night, or both, I suppose?
Yeah, in the morning more at the moment. So, for example, right now outside, it's probably about 13, 14 degrees. Okay. And then it'll get up to 31, 33. And it depends what time you're filming as well. And then if you do some shoots in the evening, I mean, I've got three jackets with me. But I have made a compromise, which I've learned over the years. I used to bring a lot of pairs of shoes.
Yeah.
I now don't bring as many shoes. I bring like one pair of shoes, like sandals, and then I bring three or four pairs of trainers so that I just rotate trainers now.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So here's a question. You know, when you check into your hotels, you know, when they have those special, like the porters, they have those big luggage trolley things. You know where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah.
And so normally when you see them wheel one of those in, you think, oh, J-Lo's coming through or something like that. Like, is it a bit like that when you turn up where suddenly there's like a sort of small flotilla of porters who are bringing all your luggage up to your room?
I don't want to shatter the illusion here, but yesterday when I arrived, it could not have been further from that. I got out of the car and I was pushing two large suitcases, a small wheelie suitcase and a handbag on top through the hotel door. And I looked like I was pushing a truck uphill the way I was handling this luggage. So I would love to think it's as glamorous as that, but it's really not. It's always me lugging it around usually.
Rachel, yeah. We jest, of course. But I mean, the serious side to this, I suppose, is that it must genuinely, much as, you know, it's fantastic flying around the world and you love what you do and you're brilliant at what you do, but it must put quite a strain on your whole home work life, does it not? You know, is it a bit of a head mash? That's head mash is not the word I was going to use, but it's a family podcast. But, you know, is it a bit of a head mash, a head melt in terms of being away that much and where the hell you are in the world?
You do need very understanding friends and family. And I'm very lucky on that front. You do have to make more effort when you're home as well. Mm. I literally will get a diary out and go, right, that day I'm going to see that person, that day I'm going to see that person. And you have to put a lot more effort in, but it is completely worth it. But for example, it's my aunt's birthday when I'm in Mexico and I'm trying to work out how I can FaceTime into her party because it's a big birthday and I really want to be there. And so I think I'm going to have to get up at like 6 a.m. in Mexico to be able to do it. But you have to put the effort in. It's things like that you have to go, right, this one's worth it. This is worth it. And it is the job is amazing and I love it. But you do have to be kind of very organized and you do have to prioritize loads of things in your life to be able to do it.
So how many days over the year are you away? I would imagine it's well into the hundreds.
Well, I'm doing 21 races this year and I did testing. So that's 22 weeks out of 52 that I'm away without holidays or anything else. So
that's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a big ask, actually.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, Crofty does all the races. So he's away for 23 weeks this year and he did testing. Mm. But I think... Listen, we're very, very lucky in the way we do it. We don't come into the track as early as others. It's the mechanics and the people who work on the teams that I feel for because they work a lot. They work long days. They work really hard and they are away from their families an awful lot. So I think F1 have got to take that into account, looking at how many races they want to do. It's all very well for those of us that can, you know, drop in and out and things. But for those doing all of them, that's a massive pressure on your families and life at home.
Mm. Yeah, I think for that reason... Is this unfair to say? But I think it's a young person's game, I think. Because otherwise, you know, you get older, you get family, you get kids and stuff. I think that'd be very difficult for most.
You're calling me young. Are you calling me young? I'll take that.
Of course. Thank you.
No, you're right. It is. Well, it's funny, though, because you see a lot of the guys, there does seem to be sort of a young element and then a much older element. And they say you kind of do F1 for sort of 3 years or 30 years. I'm on 12. Yeah. I really don't want to go to 30, but I'm somewhere in the middle right now. This is my 12th year. Yeah.
Wow.
12th or 13th. God, I can't even keep count. So 12th year, I think.
So anyway, look, this is all great stuff. But where did it all begin? I mean, obviously I know about, you know, your dad and your brothers were into motorsport. What kicked it all off?
Probably being dragged around to follow them, to be honest. But also, we had in the living room at home, we had a picture on the wall of my dad on the banking, driving around in a Ford Corsair on one of his record runs with a little Speedo embedded into the glass. And I always remember seeing that as a kid and never really asking until I was older what it was and finding out what it was. And so every day, if I went in to watch Neighbours on TV or whatever, I'd walk past this picture and see this picture on the wall. So I think it's always been there. And then I just loved being around it once I started going to the paddocks when they were there. And we watched F1 as kids all the time. And in fact, I was the one watching Imola in 94 when my brothers were outside because it was a warm, sunny day.
Yeah.
And I had to go and tell them what had happened. And I remember that really vividly as like, I was the one watching it that day and they were outside. I've got like a long-standing, you know, if I wanted to hang out with my brothers, who at the time I thought were cool, I had to sit and watch the F1 with them on a Sunday because I was the annoying little sister. So it all started from there, really.
Yeah, so it was in the blood, really, wasn't it? You know, it was, I guess, to an extent, you were predisposed to end up sort of doing what you're doing and what you're doing so well.
Yeah, on this side of it, I tried driving, I was rubbish, so I never got that part, that gene, but I got the gene of liking motorsport.
Do you have a go at the driving?
I did in 2016. So it was with Radical, with their SR1s. I know you'll know, Jason, and what those cars are like.
A proper little car, that.
Yeah, so I did some practice. On the Friday, so I raced at Alton Park. It was a two-race weekend. So I did Alton Park, which apparently is quite a difficult track to basically learn on and do your first races.
Yeah.
But I, so on the Friday in practice, I crashed at 100 miles an hour in the rain. Went off, I don't know if you know, but basically before the penultimate corner, you have a flat out section where you come under the bridge and round to the left. Yeah, and then you have the right hander. And you're supposed to be flat through there. I came up over the brow.
I'm not
the bridge,
sure that's true. Someone's told really? You a fib there. I've never been flat through druids in my life. Never.
Oh, well, I came...
I mean, it's not
up...
far off, but it isn't flat. Someone's had
well,
you over
I came
there.
Up through there, and I had my foot down, and I came over the top, and there was a pool of water. And as I landed, I hit the pool of water. So I just spun off into the barriers on the right. But there's quite a lot of grass there. So yeah. the impact wasn't anywhere near as bad as it should have been. Yeah. I took the rear wing off and things like that. And I managed to keep my foot in as well, which my instructor was most pleased about. Of anything I did the entire time he spent with me, I managed to get going again. But that was on the Friday in practice. And then, so after that, I always took my foot off through there. I couldn't get my brain to tell my foot to stay down. I couldn't physically keep it in. Mm. So qualifying, I was somewhere near the back. I wasn't last, but I was somewhere near the back. And then in the races, I came the first race, I'd overtaken somebody and I was so happy. I'd been basically stalking him for about six laps. And then out of the hairpin, I got him. For some reason, I was really quick through the hairpin. It doesn't make sense, but I was really quick through the hairpin. And I got him coming out of the hairpin and managed to stay ahead of him. And as I came around the final corner, he was trying to go up the inside. And I was like, I'm not letting you have that line. I'm going to move across there. Hit some water, spun. He got past me, lost the place, got out of the car. And Johnny Herbert, bless him, had come to watch. And I was walking up to Johnny and this little kid came towards me and said, oh, hi, can I interview you for my website? And I had to take a deep breath because I was like, oh, God, this is how it feels. Because I was so angry with myself. And this little kid's face, I was like, yes, not my complete. I don't know, I did this interview with this kid and I was like, okay, now I get what the drivers feel like when they come into me. So, yeah, it was a brilliant experience. In the second race, I ran out of fuel on the last lap. So I was I again got out of the car very upset because it was bunny hopping. I'm sure there's a technical term, but it was bunny hopping all the way around. And I'd overtaken someone again that I was really chuffed about. And I didn't know why it was doing what it was doing. I thought the gears, there was something wrong with the clutch, whatever it was. So I just pulled into the pits and didn't realize if I'd just crossed the line, I'd have kept my place because it was the last lap, but I didn't know it was the last lap. Johnny was on my pit board and he wasn't telling me the information I needed. But yeah, I ran out of fuel, so I was really upset.
Rachel, back to the day job then. In terms of, you know, you professionally, you rub shoulders with the heroes of F1, you have their trust and they let you into their world, which I guess is all about trust and it's all about access. So many memorable experiences over the years, I would imagine, for you, having done it 12, 13 years, as you say. But is there one standout pinch yourself moment that will live with you forever?
My pinch myself moments have probably all culminated. They're several into one, essentially. And it's getting to speak to the world champion just after it's happened. When Lewis started winning titles again in 2014, I was the first person that he spoke to in the pen because we're British media as well. And he came to us first. And they're in the highest of highs, or it's that moment they've dreamt of all their life. And I've got the privilege of speaking to them at that point. And I don't think you ever get over that. And I will always look back really fondly on those moments because you just, in what sport do you get to do that? Generally, it's so rare that I...
Good point.
Yeah, those will always go down as my pinch me moments. And then there was one where I called President Clinton Bill and I got people telling me off because apparently you always call an ex-president Mr. President. And I went, Bill, can I have a word?
Is that right?
I wouldn't have known that. I'd have made that mistake as well.
Right?
But they're not Mr. President anymore. His term's over.
You have to call them Mr. President for the rest of their lives. So I went, Bill, and his security put this big hand up at me. And he turned around and talked to me. And I was like, me and Bill, we're like that. It's fine.
You see, the funny thing about that, though, Rachel, is that appears to be completely the wrong way around to me. Because actually, you would think that you call them Mr. President while they are Mr. President, right?
Yes.
And then when they're not, you should then call them Bill or whatever their name is. So maybe we should have an amendment to that, Jason. Yeah.
But do you know what? Going back to what you've said about, you know, those lovely, precious moments, actually, I bet you can really... I mean, I was going to say, you can see it in there. You can see something really special, but you're part of a really amazing moment. Can you... I mean, obviously you feel it, but can you see that in them?
But it's interesting because
I feel like sometimes it's so fresh to them that it actually hasn't sunk in yet.
Ah.
So there's you're in this kind of weird gap in the middle between them doing it and them actually realizing it. And yeah. So that little bit in the middle is just a really weird moment because you want to try and draw out so much emotion from them, but it hasn't hit them yet. Yeah. So it's a really hard interview to do because although it sounds really easy, yeah. Oh, he's world champion, he's going to be over the moon. He's not really sort of comprehended it yet. He's not reacting yet to what's actually happened. And it's probably the moment after they've left the pen and they go back to their driver's room and sit down and then go, oh my God, I've done it.
Yeah.
So well, it's all a really, the adrenaline. Actually a really difficult interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the adrenaline still full of the, you know, it's in the system, isn't it? And actually that's not real, is it? Do you know what I mean? You're running on chemicals and they're programmed to be like that. So yeah, perhaps you're right. It's only when he gets back to, like you say, his driver's room, does the gravity of the whole situation just sink in.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, talking to Max after he won, Max won after the sprint in Japan, and I mean, it's a little bit of an anticlimax when it comes after a sprint, but to be fair to him, he's done so incredibly well this year that, you applaud it whenever it happens. But it's so hard to get emotion out of him. It's so hard. But he walked up to me and you think, what question can you ask him right now that I haven't asked him all year? Because he's just dominated throughout. Yeah. And I just reeled off the other names in F1 who've won 3 titles. So you've got your Brabhams, your Lauders, Senna, Piquet, you know, and I just, I reeled those off to him and Stewart, of course. And I wanted that to sink in to see if that would help and say to him, because I just read their names and I added his name on the end. And I said, how does that sound? And he did give us lovely answers. You know, he said, as a kid, you know, you dream of doing this. But it's just it's such a hard interview. It's one of the hardest interviews I do, definitely.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, he is extraordinary, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those where I know Seb, for his titles, people said, oh, he had the best car. And then Lewis won a load. And they're like, oh, yeah, but he had the best car. And you always try and quantify their achievement somehow, but why? I mean, he's incredibly good at what he does. He's on the absolute peak right now, and if he's not at the peak, heck, you know, the others have all got something to worry about. And he's driving a phenomenal car. He's just brought it all together, and he's not got there by luck, so you know, he's doing a fantastic job. But you always want to see the very best drivers in the same car, don't you? You always want to say, what would Lewis do in that car? What would Fernando do in that car? What
I was thinking, you know, exactly Lando doing that car. I was thinking exactly that as you were speaking. You know, that's what's, you know, if there's anything we could magic, or I guess you would be the same, but I could magically make happen about Formula One is, you know, I want 4 Red Bulls out there and I want the 4 best guys in it, just so we know. But do you know what? We do know anyway. It'd be a hell of a race. And I don't think Max would be up the road. I think it would be a proper scrap between... You know, I'm glad you mentioned Alonso there. I mean, he's an all-time favourite of mine. He'd be right in the mix, wouldn't he?
Oh, 100%. 100%. It's funny. So I did something with him and Lance earlier this year, and it was away from cameras. We were going between 2 sites. And I was just chatting to him, and I just said to him, you know, do you ever worry there's going to be a point where you feel like I'm losing my edge, I'm losing my reaction time, or I'm losing this, or I'm losing, you know, my spatial awareness is diminishing something, because he's in his 40s, he's 41, 42 now. And you just think, and he said to me, no, he said, I'm better than I ever was. Mm. And he said, I'm actually driving better, thinking better, functioning better than I was in my 20s.
Yeah. I believe
it. And he said, it's because of everything I've learnt along the way that I'm now able to do this. Whereas you talk to other drivers and they're like, no, I got to 40 and I started to lose pace, or I started to lose this or that or the other. He feels right now, he says, that he's the best he's ever been.
It's interesting though, isn't it? You know, and Rachel, talking about phenomenal cars and phenomenal drivers, you know, passing your test, we always say, is a rite of passage, right? It's something that you will never forget. I'd imagine that being brought up in a real petrolhead motorsport family with your dad and your brothers and stuff like that, passing your test was something that you were itching to do. Can you remember the moment? And can you remember the first car that you were set free on the roads in?
So I passed my test on the second time.
Okay.
I failed the first time because I was coming off a roundabout, and it's in Redhill in Surrey, and there's a roundabout by a leisure centre where there are the normal 3-4 exits, but there's a tiny little half exit to some shops. Mm. And the instructor had said, you need to take, you know, the exit over the bridge, whatever it was. And I put my indicator on just before the half exit. And because it was so little distance between the two, he failed me because he said I indicated that I was going off at the first exit and I was actually taking the second. I put my indicator on too early.
He was a jockey,
and
wasn't he?
Furious. But then I passed the second time, so it wasn't a problem. And I had a Mark One Golf.
Oh, that's a decent, really classic old Golf.
I know. I saved up for it. I worked in McDonald's part time to save up to buy it.
Good on you.
And I had a Mark One Golf. And I still remember the number plate, BLR790Y.
Oh, listen. Don't get us started on this.
Honestly, head exploded.
This takes Jason down a really, really dark place because he can't understand the fact that normal people, Rachel, and like you and
me, that's not fair.
No, this is fair because people are into cars, right? I remember every single registration plate of every single car that I've ever owned, and indeed every car that my dad ever had from about my age of about 3 or 4 onwards, right? That's normal.
Dave, that's weird. No, Dave, that's weird. I remember two number plates. I remember two number plates and my current one, and that's it. So I'm sorry, Dave. That's weird.
Enough.
I'm with Jason on this.
Rachel, it's been lovely having you on the show.
whoa. There's loads more to go.
You can't remember all of them.
All of them.
That's like
all
someone remembering all the phone numbers in their phone.
All of them. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what I had for lunch yesterday, but I can tell you what the registration was on the white Capri that I had, you know, in the late 90s. It was D205WMY. You know, and see, I know these things.
Probably a talent you can make money out of
maybe, somewhere.
Hey, Rain Man. Slightly Rain Man-ish.
That's very true.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, do you know what? I think we all are. We're all on the spectrum because guess what? Look at how our lives are and what do we do? And we're, you know, we have passion for our work and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, let's not go down that rabbit hole. However, do you know what? He's not the only one because we've had quite a few guests on and this is cropped up. And there's quite a few. Was it AC/DC? He could remember all the Regis.
Yeah. Brian could. Yeah.
Brian.
Brian Johnson could remember every Reg that he's ever had. You see, I don't think it's that unusual, but maybe it is.
It's a gift.
It depends how long you have the cars for, I guess, as well, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
When you do parking apps on your phone now and you have to put in your registration and stuff, I think that helps us remember them a lot. We've put it down on way more things than we used to, but I can only remember, I think, three in my current one, so 4 in total. Mm. I think that's probably it.
Can't remember any, not one.
Not a single one, Jason. Hang on. I mean, to be fair, without giving it away, your current one is very easy to remember.
Well, yes, obviously that one. I can remember that one because that's a personal
place. Is it Plato 1?
it's not even as complicated as that.
It doesn't even have the 1 on the end of it. It just says Plato. Oh, no, I've told everyone. Oh, God, what would be, you know, what's next on the radar? What do you fancy?
I'd love to go and watch the Indy 500. I'd love to actually go and watch one of those live. That would be amazing. I've been to 24-hour races, but I haven't been to Le Mans. So I've been to the 24 hours at Nürburgring, and there was a 24 hours in Portugal that both my brothers took part in. Okay. So I've been to those, and I've done the sleeping on chairs and all that kind of stuff. But I'd like to actually go to Le Mans as well one year, 24 hours of Le Mans, and just really enjoy that. But yeah, and the Indy 500, my brain still can't compute the whole 500 laps. Like, how do you keep your concentration and keep your foot in like that for so long? It's just incredible.
I went for the first time for the 100th running and man, it's something else. So, I mean, I've watched it a lot, but to actually witness it in the flesh, I mean, it's mental. It's insane. And you find yourself turning into an American. I mean, I kept on putting my hand up here when a plane came over and got involved in the whole build up, the whole razzmatazz. It was a mess, and everything works.
Yeah.
You know, if you're hungry, you get food. The tannoy works. It was amazing. What a spectacle! So yeah, you've got to do that.
They put on an incredible show. They really do. And I think we are starting to learn from that as well. I mean, especially in Formula One as well at the moment, we are learning a lot more. I mean, Brad Pitt's doing a film about Formula One. This is, you know, it's brilliant.
He's looking a bit rough, isn't he, these days? Don't you think? How does he do it?
He's amazing. He was here last year at the race, and I got probably my shortest interview ever with him, which was about 5 seconds. But we were all told that he probably wasn't going to talk to anyone. So he was walking past me in the paddock, and I just said, "Oh, you having a good weekend?" And he answered and said he was, and then he was gone. That was it.
Actually, just going on about, we've learned a bit from Americans, do you think? Is, if you could compare all the races over the years and the build-up, is the American quite a standout in that it's very different?
You definitely feel like you're part of something at the American races. Okay. Mm-hmm. Massively. It's an actual event, whereas there are some you go to where it's really quiet and you don't feel as if it's, people are aware of it. You go to others where the fans just make it phenomenal. I mean, Silverstone, the fans of Silverstone, the fans in the Netherlands, they blow you away with just their passion and their enthusiasm and the way they make it such a celebration. Whereas in America, the fans are incredible, but they also put on a show around it that the fans will buy into. So it's different in that sense. So for me, it doesn't need to be an event as long as the fans are there. But if the fans aren't there, then you need to make it an event. But America seemed to be able to do both really well.
Both,
Rachel, away from America and all the glitz and razzmatazz, I want to ask you about perhaps another motoring itch, electric cars. Have you, do you, would you? What's your take?
It's definitely not an itch or an itch I want to scratch, to be honest, right now. I feel we have to do stuff. We have to do stuff to look after the environment. We have to do that. I just feel that electric maybe came in a bit quickly. We didn't have the infrastructure for it. I mean, my hat goes off to people who've bought electric cars and are pursuing with it because, you know, I know people who rave about them and will never, you know, drive petrol, diesel, anything else again. But you haven't just got the concerns about, you know, will you be able to charge it? Will you be able to get far enough? You haven't just got the concerns about the cost of the batteries and how long they last and how we dispose of them. But they're also heavier. Electric cars are much heavier. Our multi-storey car parks can't necessarily cope right now. They might be bringing in weight restrictions. You also, when you have an impact with an electric car, it's more force than a diesel or petrol car because it's so much heavier. And so you have to look at whether road crashes involving electric cars are causing more fatalities. There's so much more to electric cars than just we're saving the planet that I feel like they were rushed through a little bit too much. And I, at the moment, don't feel, I mean, I can't afford to change that quickly anyway, my car, but I don't feel at the moment that that's the answer. I think sustainable fuels is the answer. And the more money and the time and the research we pile into the sustainable fuels and we get something that's less damaging on that, down that route, for me is the way forward. I feel like electric is bringing us too many problems right now, if I'm honest. And roads as well, the roads, you know, they'll struggle under the weight. These roads we've had for God knows how many decades, you know, these heavier cars are causing issues.
Do you know what? All really valid points, sir. Really valid points. It's hard to disagree with that.
Absolutely. You know, this is a question that we ask everybody. And I think the interesting thing about this, Rachel, is that everybody has a viewpoint. And every time we ask it, we learn something different. You know, we'd never had the discussion before about the weight and the potential, you know, different impacts that are there. So, yeah, I feel like if nothing else, Jason, we learn stuff week by week, don't we, on the whole thing? And it helps to kind of formulate our opinion, which isn't cut and dried either, you know. And I agree with all that you said, Rachel. You know, yes, we do need to be doing things and we do need to make a change and we can't carry on with the destruction that we're doing now. But is full-on electric the answer? I'm not sure, you know, and I think maybe a sort of sustainable fuels hybrid with some electric could be the answer. But, you know, we'll wait and see, and we'll see what the world gives us in the next 5 to 10 years.
I also think I definitely use my car less. So I use, because my car's still petrol, I use it less. I'm looking for other ways to get places. Definitely doing that now, because I do believe I want to do my bit. But I also, I mean, I had a hydrogen taxi the other day. Have you had a hydrogen car yet?
No.
Oh, no.
Right. So this guy turns up. What, in the UK? In the UK. And he's riding a hydrogen car. I think is it a Mirai? I could be wrong. But it was a taxi. And he turned up and I asked him about it. And he was telling me all about it. And he's a taxi driver. And he said, the problem with a hydrogen car is it uses more energy, more hydrogen on a motorway than it does in traffic. It's the opposite of what you'd expect.
Okay.
But he said that there are so few hydrogen pumps in the country right now but it's really hard for him. And a lot of them are around airports, essentially. Mm. So he was telling me about the ones around Gatwick. And he said he went there one day and the pumps break a lot at the moment. So that when he went to the hydrogen pump to use it, it wasn't working. So they have to call out an engineer. And he waited 5 hours for an engineer. And he's a taxi driver.
That's a lot of fares.
Yeah, and I said to him, why do you do it? And he said, because it's for my kid's future. And I said, I totally understand that. And wow, you know, I have so much respect to you, because that is affecting your income by the fact that you're trying to do this. But he wants to do his bit. So let's plough more resources into hydrogen. Let's, you know, let's... I mean, the car was amazing. I was a little bit worried when he filled it up when I was sat in it. I was like, this is really weird. He's pumping like literal gas into the car right now, and I don't know enough about hydrogen to know if I'm safe sitting here. But I'm definitely not going to get my phone out or light a match. But it was interesting. You know, there are other people are thinking of other things, and they are coming through. So,
yeah.
I must admit, I didn't think there was any hydrogen cars in the UK. I didn't even know there's pumps. Wow.
Yeah.
So, well, let's get back to your cars then, Rach. So this is a question we ask a lot of our guests, and that is, of all the cars you've owned, if you just had to only pick one and live with for the rest of your life, just the one, what would it be?
God, if I could have my Golf back, I had a Golf GTI for a while. I'd have a Golf GTI 2 liter at least, really, you know, but with the modern perks inside. I want my heated seat back for the winters. I'm not that happy.
Apple CarPlay.
And the Mark 1 definitely did not have that, I tell you that. It was a choke and everything. I mean, I had to pull the choke out on cold mornings and everything. So if I could have the modern perks inside like an old Golf GTI and something like that, I think I would love to go back to that. Yeah. Definitely.
Good choice.
It was just nippy, wasn't it? I mean, you go into BMW or an Audi or whatever and you feel you're driving a car, but I just loved how nippy it felt and I could always park it because I'm terrible.
Well, actually, if you look at pictures now with those old cars to new cars, even a modern day Golf to a Mark 1 Golf, God, they were small. Or I should say, new cars are massive.
Yes.
And they're heavy. And, you know, I can remember, you know, jumping in a Golf, a Peugeot 205 GTI a few years ago. And I had one originally, way back when. But I was doing some fit filming. It was insane. It was magical.
Yeah,
like almost like sat in a greenhouse because there was no airbags everywhere.
Yes, I mean,
just light and nippy, and but it was great, great.
And
cars.
If you're too hot, you just wound your window down.
Yeah, you did, didn't you? Yeah, yeah. God, can you imagine we used to do that? We used to crank the windows down. Oh my God!
But there's a reason why you don't see many of those on the roads anymore, because most of them ended up in ditches or around trees, didn't they? Unfortunately, which is such a shame because they were a beautiful, beautiful little car. And I think you're right. I think the size of them was what it was all about, because they were, you know, they were nimble. That's probably the word, weren't they? Yeah. They were light and zippy and nimble, and that's why they were so fun. Rachel, I know that we need to let you go in a second because we're running out of time and you've got busy Formula One business to do over there in Austin, Texas. So here's the final question for you. Jason and I always say that music and cars go well together, we think. So we want your fantasy drive, please. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you driving?
God, wow. Oh, you've just thrown that at me, haven't you? I'm in my Gullwing, my 300 SL Gullwing Mercedes, and I'm doing a road trip across America. Nice. And I'm taking in Nashville, New Orleans, all these live music places along the way. I'm going coast to coast. I'm starting on the east, ending up on the west.
Yep.
And I'm listening. So I'm... This is my crazy life. So when I get back from Brazil on the Monday evening, I then fly on the Tuesday to a concert in Hamburg in Germany for one night, because the band are playing in the UK while I'm in America and they're playing in Europe while I'm back in the UK. So I'm flying to Germany for one night with my best friend to go and see the band. And it's a band called Fallout Boy. I don't know if you've heard of them.
Yes, of course.
Right. So I'm going to sit, and I would be playing there all their music really loudly as I had the roof down or I had the windows open or in my girl wing, whatever. And I'm going along and listening to that, doing a road trip across the US. And then I'd go and stop off at these other places and listen to other live music on the way, I think.
Sounds magical.
I think it's lovely. And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Well, sadly, we do need to wrap it up. So that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thank you. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, live and direct from the USA, the one and only Rachel Brooks. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you. Bye.
Really, really nice. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us, as always, on Twitter at Jason Plater or at David Bitty. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating. Press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll catch you next time. Ta-da.